Well, have you ever heard of a skinwalker? According to the myths of Native Americans, the skinwalkers are evil medicine men, or even the enchanted corpses of medicine men. Either way, they're supposed to be possessed by a demon. They have pale white skin, and according to some, a preference for human flesh. But whatever happened on a remote ranch in Utah? In a moment, hunt for the skinwalker with Colm Kelleher and George Knapp on Coast to Coast. AM. George Knapp is an 8-time Emmy Award-winning journalist whose reporting on Nevada's infamous Area 51 military base was selected by UPI as the best individual achievement by a reporter in 1989. Other awards include the Associated Press's Mark Twain Award for News Writing and the very prestigious Edward R. Murrow Award for Investigative Reporting. George is an anchor and reporter for the CBS affiliate KLIS-TV in Las Vegas, and also writes a weekly column for a Las Vegas newspaper. He's our guest on Coast to Coast. George, welcome to the program. We're going to keep you up for a long time tonight.
That's what I'm here for, George. Thanks for having us.
And by the way, I just want you to know I have been a fan of yours for a number of years, and it's an honor to have you on Coast to Coast with us tonight.
Well, I'm really pleased that you asked us, and the feeling is mutual. I'm a fan of yours as well. This is the place to get this kind of information.
Colm Kelleher, PhD, is a research scientist. He's an author currently in the biotechnology sector. Dr. Kelleher is a biochemist with a 20-year research career in cell and molecular biology, following his PhD in biochemistry from the University of Dublin, Trinity College, 1983. Dr. Kelleher worked at the Ontario Cancer Institute, the Terry Fox Cancer Research Laboratory, and the National Jewish Center for Immunology and Respiratory Medicine. Before moving to the biotechnology sector and as a senior research scientist, he worked as a project manager and team leader at a private research institute from 1996 to 2004, using forensic science to unravel scientific anomalies. He is back on Coast to Coast. Colm, good to have you.
Great to be here again, George. It's been a while.
What an incredible story that you two were part of, witnesses of. Let's start, first of all, Colm, if you can just tell me just a little bit of your relationship with George Knapp, how that started, and then we'll get into this. And George, before you're off with us tonight on this three-hour extravaganza, we're going to have to talk with you about Area 51 as well, okay?
I kind of thought that might be coming.
What a newsman. What an instinct you have for news. Colm, how did the relationship start with you and George?
Well, George has actually had a relationship with Robert Bigelow, who is the CEO of the National Institute for Discovery Science, going all the way back into the 1990s and even earlier, I believe. So when Robert Bigelow formed the National Institute for Discovery Science in 1995, George was already part of the brainstorming process. So over the years, as NIDS became more and more of a scientific organization, when staff scientists were hired, when the Science Advisory Board was put together, George was a constant sounding board throughout that whole process. So he was kind of, a fly on the wall, so to speak, over many, many years with respect to the formation of NIDS and the projects that were going on with NIDS. So he, I think, of any journalist has had a bird's eye view of the whole process.
And is that relationship then, is that how you and George developed a working relationship?
That's correct. Towards the end of the stint at NIDS, George was probably the only journalist that was really allowed on the property up in the northeastern Utah that we're going to be discussing. And he spent quite a while up there. So gradually, as the research came to fruition, so to speak, George in 2002 issued a couple of articles written in a Las Vegas newspaper that essentially put the whole Utah ranch on the map globally. There was a tremendous amount of interest in those two articles that they were the first documentation of some of the activity that had happened on the Utah ranch. And that was really the beginning of this whole lengthy process where we began to collaborate on a book.
George, as you know, working in the mainstream media, I've been there before. It's very difficult to get news directors and other executives interested in the unusual, the mysteries, the paranormal. You've made a career out of this in Las Vegas especially. How did you get interested in this field? How did a newsman with a great guts for news then begin to realize there's a little bit more out there on this planet?
It started with the Area 51 stuff, which we'll talk about later. I had the same kind of general curiosity about UFOs that probably everyone has, but had never really done any serious work until a guy named John Lear came into the station. And John Lear, people have different opinions about him, but he had a certain amount of credibility with KLAS-TV, where I work, because he'd been instrumental in helping us to break the story of the stealth fighter, which was being tested out at Area 51. It was a national story, and John was very helpful in helping us to break it. And because of that, he would come into the station with other story ideas, and one of them was about UFOs and what was going on at Area 51. He came in with a pile of documents one day trying to interest my mentor, the late Ned Day, into pursuing this matter. Ned would have no part of it because of the kind of stigma that you're referring to,
yep.
George. And but I was eavesdropping, as usual, and I said, hey, let me take a look at that stuff. And I thought it was kind of interesting. I put John Lear on a program that I produced, a little public affairs program that is aired in the middle of the night and that nobody watches. And suddenly the phone is ringing off the hook and people are expressing interest in it. I had Lear on again, and the response was bigger. I had him on a third time, and which is when he started talking about the rumors about Area 51, and the response was even bigger. And I realized, hey, this is really something that touches the pulse of the public. It has not been given a fair shake by journalism, certainly, and by science. And so I started taking a look at it and looking into the material, and I realized, you know, 90% of the sightings can be explained. 95% of all the conspiracy theories are probably nonsense, but at the core, there is an unexplained essence that deserves some serious scrutiny, because this could be the biggest story of all time. So that's how I got started.
Had you not been in the market that you are in, would your path, your career path, have taken a different twist?
Probably. I mean, the trust that KLAS gave me then and still gives me now is probably unique. You don't see a lot of people in my profession who do more than a passing story here or there, a feature, a kind of a yuck kind of a put down of the topic. And the fact that they gave me the freedom to pursue the Area 51 stuff and UFOs in general really is a unique development.
And I want everyone to know that George Knapp is known throughout the UFO community, throughout the investigative community, for his work, because there aren't a lot of hard news mainstream newscasters who go out there and do this kind of investigating. Of course, Linda Moulton Howe used to do some of that when she was in Boston as a producer. But George Knapp is doing this now as a career at the television station he's at, the CBS affiliate in Las Vegas, KLAS. And he's doing just yeoman's work, breaking stories all around the country. And, you know, I got to tell you, I've tapped into some of his work to use as stories during my days in St. Louis. I mean, it is mind-blowing. You don't win 8 Emmys by being lucky. You don't win an Edward R. Murrow Award for investigative training in work by being lucky. He's done a thorough job. This is going to be a fascinating program tonight. Colm and George, regardless of who I address any questions to tonight on this incredible story, The Hunt for the Skinwalker, both of you jump in at any time. Consider this just a discussion, as opposed to an interview. This area in northeastern Utah has a reputation for strange phenomena. Tell me, either one of you jump in on this one, tell me about this region. What are we talking about here?
Colm, why don't you start?
Well, it's a region that is about 150 miles south or east of Salt Lake City. It's off the beaten track, so It is pretty isolated. It is obviously dominated by the Mormon community, but it also has a fairly big Native American presence in the case of the Utes. And it lies between Vernal, and Roosevelt. They're basically the towns that are involved. So the ranch is in the middle of the Uinta Basin, which has had at least a 50-year history, almost continuous history of bizarre activity. And that was documented beginning in 1951 by a chap called Junior Hicks, who happened to be the local science teacher. So he and a bunch of his students in 1951 had a dramatic sighting of this large object during the daylight, when half the school was looking up at this object going across the school. And this kind of convinced him that something unusual was in the sky. So he became the unofficial source of a lot of these the reports throughout the basin.
Junior Hicks actually developed a catalog of more than 400 pretty interesting cases, and he got so many of the cases because the UFO sightings were so frequent in the area that he mostly concentrated on the most dramatic ones, close encounter type incidents where beings were seen and saucers landed, things of that sort. And he's a pretty thorough investigator, and because he lived in the area, people trusted him, and he didn't reveal their identities or make fun of them, so he got more and more information over the years. He was a very valuable resource for us, but what it indicated to us is his catalog was that this has been going on a long time. He even found records that indicate that the area had the first white settlers in the area, the Spanish explorers who went through there in the 1770s, had their own UFO experiences, what we'd call UFO experiences. So it's been going on a long time. And then, of course, he also collected the lore from the Ute tribe that had been there, and they had indicated that the stories go back many, many generations.
This picture on your book, Hunt for the Skinwalker, it looks like a small ranch. The house is very modest.
Oh, it is. It's one of the typical homesteads that flourished in that area in the 1920s, 1930s. And it is right in the middle of this Ute reservation. It's kind of interesting. It's bounded on a couple of sides by the Ute reservation. But it is a very small homestead, and the ranch is a 480-acre property. The homestead lies just pretty well at the eastern edge of the property, but even during the 1920s and 1930s, there were other homesteads on that property too, which have since been abandoned. But this is not a luxury living kind of a situation. It is pretty remote, and it's pretty basic.
And we should point out that for all the lore about the Uinta Basin that goes back so many years, the central focus of the activity has always been this particular ranch. That is where the title for the book comes from. The Ute tribe refers to this 480-acre property as the Path of the Skinwalker. They sort of use it as a blanket explanation to compensate for all of the strange activity that they have witnessed on that property for so many generations.
Do you think anything has happened on this property in years gone past that was probably one of the reasons why there's been so much unusual activity in this area?
That's very, very difficult to say. We, the NIDS organization actually did interview a few people who worked on the property in the 1970s. And we actually also interviewed the previous owners to the Gorman family, who occupied the property from 1994 through 1996. The previous owners were a family from Salt Lake City, and they owned the property stretching back at least 20 years. But prior to that, it gets pretty misty. We actually looked in the local Mormon records in Vernal for property transfers, and we went to the local property office too. It gets pretty misty beyond the 1960s going back. But you know, one could speculate that a lot of the strange phenomena may be tied geographically to that spot rather than be associated with the people. And the evidence that we have from the interviews of people who have occupied the ranch before that seems to indicate that it may be tied to the geography rather than the occupants of the ranch.
And Cullum, how often were you out in this region? How much time did you spend there?
Well, once the family had basically decided to sell the property to the National Institute for Discovery Science, That happened in August of 1996. We essentially were living on the property pretty well all the time through 1996. We stopped for a while in the winter of 96, began early in 1997, went all the way through 1997. There were occasions, a few days here and there, when we weren't on the property, but then the ranch manager would call us and we would get back on the property. Then through 1998, strong presence on the property. After that, we had a couple of investigators who would go there between the end of 1998 all the way through 2002. So there was almost a continuous presence of researchers on the property beginning in August of 1996.
And George, how about you as an investigative reporter? Would you periodically pop down to the property?
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't get there until most of the most dramatic events had already occurred. I was begging to go, but that just wasn't in the cards. I've only made five visits to the property. But I had access to all of the reports as they were pouring in through NIDS, and Colin would share information with me as well as Bob Bigelow. So I knew what was going on, was privy to it, and it drove me absolutely crazy that I was not allowed to be there for a while. But you have to understand, George, that, they didn't want to attract a lot of attention to the property.
Right.
The interactive nature of the phenomena made it essential that you didn't have a lot of interlopers or people parking in RVs and having tailgate parties and things of that sort, because it would interfere with the research and you didn't know what the results would be.
Could either one of you feel strange vibes from the area when you were there, Colm, George?
There was really, during the hundreds of days that I was on the property, there was really only once or twice when I felt that there was anything remotely bizarre, and that was one occasion in particular, and this was probably in 1997, actually, early summer of 1997, when myself and this other investigator were walking slowly through this thick undergrowth brush on the property. We were tracking these unusual footprints that we had found. We had just gone through the process of documenting them, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I had this distinct feeling of being watched, and it was a pretty unique feeling. It was like something was very, very close to me.
I'll tell you that
I had a very strong smell, like a strong odor, very heavy sulfur. I glanced to the investigator who was just like a couple of hundred feet away. He had obviously felt or sensed something also. So later on, we didn't actually communicate at that time. I looked around and continued the tracking process, but we debriefed later on, and we found that at that precise time, both of us had this distinct feeling of being watched. Something was very close to us. We couldn't see it. It was broad daylight. That was really the only time that I felt physically threatened, so to speak, on the property.
How about you, George?
I know my feeling was different. I basically anticipated a feeling of dread when I got on the property because I'd read some of the dramatic things that had happened, dangerous things, violent things. But the feeling I had was one of calm and peace, and it's a overwhelming sort of a feeling that I've had each time I visited the place. And I've since talked to other people who have the same sort of a feeling of calm, that it's a good sort of a sense, as strange as that may sound.
When we come back, we're going to really get into this story. It's an incredible story, the hunt for the skinwalker and some of the things that went on this property. Our guests tonight, Colm Kelleher and George Knapp. Colm's website, of course, huntfortheskinwalker.com or colmkelleher.com. Both of those websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com, and also for George Knapp, part of the huntfortheskinwalker.com website as well. Makes it very easy to get to when you go to the coasttocoastam.com website. We'll be back in a moment with both of them as we continue now this discussion of this truly remarkable story, including some incredible creatures that have been seen in that area as well. Vanishing and mutilated cattle, unidentified flying objects, and the appearance of some of these huge, otherworldly creatures. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we're back with Colm Kelleher and George Knapp as we talk about this incredible story called The Hunt for the Skinwalker. Colm and George, your book talks about for more than 50 years there have been bizarre events at that remote Utah ranch. Is that because it's been documented? Is it possible that this could have been going on there for hundreds of years just on that bare land?
Oh, I think that's more than possible because, you know, as we mentioned earlier, Junior Hicks was really the person that that started getting things organized in terms of collating all of the information. Everybody trusted this guy because he was a pillar of the community. Not only was he high up in the Mormon establishment, but he was also a high school teacher, you know, carries a certain amount of cachet.
Mm-hmm.
So gradually, beginning in 1951, he became the focus of all of the reports throughout the community. He established a reputation for never, spreading rumors about what people had told him and keeping people's confidences. So over a period of a few decades, he accumulated between 400 and 500 cases, and they were specifically selected to eliminate all of the lights in the sky, the distant stuff that was happening to people. The 400 to 500 cases that he documented were all up close and personal. A lot of them were daylight sightings. A lot of them were really sort of multiple witness sightings, too. There was a book actually written in the 1970s by Frank Salisbury, who was a Utah plant biochemist. And he basically took Junior Hicks's data, put it into a book, and the book sold extremely well because it was written by a scientist. And throughout the 1970s and 80s, these incidents kept on happening up till the arrival of NIDS in 1996. Junior Hicks also worked as a electrical contractor throughout the Uinta Basin, so he was familiar with the ranch. And, you know, he had seen stuff on the property even before we arrived.
We're going to talk about the family that was the focus of the Skinwalker book in just a second. But when I introduced both of you, I talked a little bit about skinwalkers and what, at least a definition of some Native Americans, what they might be. And they all seem to agree that they're demonically possessed or some kind of evil surrounds these. Do you believe that's the case?
Well, I mean, the Native Americans sure do. They take it very seriously, and the evidence of that is the fact how hard it was for us to get any of them to talk to us about it. You research the lore. Anthropologists have addressed this in several academic treatises, and it's clear that the Navajo, the Utes, and the Hopi and other tribes all have their versions of skinwalkers, but it's basically the same thing, that this is an evil sorcerer, a witch, capable of shape-shifting, turning into animals, werewolves, that sort of thing. And nothing but bad things come from skinwalkers. So when the Ute tribe deemed this property that we're talking about as it being in the path of the skinwalker, they were basically admonishing their members not to go on the property, to stay away from it, because it was a place of evil.
I was going to say, they tried to ignore that region for as long as they could, couldn't they?
Yeah, exactly. And some of them have gone on it, but, you know, and we're not saying we're taking skinwalkers at face value, that they're real. But the Navajo and the Utes certainly take them as real, and that has spilled over into the study that was done by NIDS.
Tell me about the family, the Gorman family. Who were they?
Well, they were a ranching family that had come in from out of state in late 1994. They really wanted to get away from the small town sort of gossiping. So they wanted to get a secluded property, and when they found this property in northeastern Utah, they were absolutely delighted. Tom Gorman was a rancher. He specialized in artificial insemination of high end cattle,
mm-hmm.
mostly Black Angus and Simmentals, and he bred these animals. They were all registered animals. They were all very, very valuable in the thousands of dollars. So his ranching operation was very, very different from the standard operation that was in the Uinta Basin. And within a couple of years of him arriving there, he had established a reputation as somebody who could sell very, very high end cattle. And you know, people came from out of state actually to buy his animals. So this was not your normal sort of ranching operation at all. It was specific. He did all of the artificial insemination himself, so he had quite a reputation. So if and when he lost an animal, which did happen very quickly after the family arrived on the property, it was a very, very big deal. Normal attrition for ranching operations, especially small ranches, are in the sort of 2 to 3%. If this guy lost one animal out of 100, it was a very big deal because of the economics of his operation.
Oh, sure. This was a prized breeding stock for him, I'm sure.
Exactly. That was the case. So so the family moved on to this property, which had been abandoned for about 7 years before they had moved on. And they moved on in late 1994. So it was shortly thereafter that things began to get very strange.
What kind of things happened to the Gorman family there?
Well, George, maybe you could relate the wolf story.
Well, on the first day that they were moving onto the property, as they are unloading their stuff, they noticed there was a large animal out on the edge of one of these pastures, and it was a wolf. And they sort of remarked to each other, "Hey, we didn't realize there were wolves in this area." And this thing was slowly sidling its way across the pasture toward them. And they surmised that, hey, this thing is not only a wolf, it's a huge wolf. I mean, larger than it, the size of a small horse, and it appeared to be tamed. Suddenly it comes walking into the midst of where the family is standing next to the corral and sidles up to them, and they assume it's tame. They could smell it had been raining. They could smell a wet dog sort of a smell. And this thing is walking among them, and it suddenly sees a calf that's in the corral next to them and walks towards it and snaps its jaws snout of this calf and is trying to pull it through these bars. The rancher, of course, reacted quickly. He starts kicking the wolf. It makes no impact. He grabbed a baseball bat or an axe handle and starts whacking it on the back. It doesn't even flinch. It's paying no attention to him. He sends his son over to the truck to grab a .357 Magnum handgun, the most powerful handgun in the world, and shoots this thing. Doesn't budge. Shoots it again. Shoots it a third time. It was on the third shot that the wolf sort of lets go of the calf, but it's just standing there. It's not bleeding. It's not making any noise. It's showing no signs of distress whatsoever. They're stunned, quite frankly, stunned and frightened by it. They go into the house, grab a powerful .30-06 hunting rifle. The guy, this rancher Gorman, was a world-class hunter, and he tells the family basically stand back, takes a shot at this thing, blasts it, and again, no impact. He takes another shot, a fifth shot, should have brought down anything, any kind of animal, an elephant, an elk,
sure.
Anything. A chunk of flesh flies off the wolf, and it just sort of, it still is not crying, nothing, showing no signs of distress. It sort of walks slowly, walks away, and starts leaving, walking back across the pasture where it came from. Well, they realize something really unusual is happening here, so they grabbed another hunting rifle and go after it. They track it through this underbrush and into this this wet area near a creek that borders the property. They're following the tracks through the brush and can see them very clearly in the mud. They get to a point, and the tracks just disappear.
Poof.
The animal just disappeared into thin air. They go back and picked up the chunk of flesh that had flown off the wolf from the last shot, and it was flesh that looked like it had been out on the property, out in the sun for several days, rotten, decayed, very, very strange. That's
strange.
Day one.
The family at that point, were they even contemplating getting out of there?
Well, I think the reaction was they were totally mystified by what had happened because they had no knowledge. The previous owners had not said anything to them about anything unusual on the property. So I think they were prepared to forget about that incident as quickly as possible. Now, the interesting thing was in the next couple of months, they had talked with some of their neighbors, and their neighbors had said, you know, there's a herd of really big wolves on your property. So they were at least sort of mollified because they knew that other people had seen these animals also. Within a few weeks, the wife was coming back from town, and she had stopped her gray Chevette at the gate of the property. It was just locking the gate, having opened it, and she noticed one of these animals right beside her car. And she figured that the animal was so big. This was not your ordinary size wolf. This animal was so big that it was almost reaching the roof of the Chevette. She was terrified by the size of the thing. These animals were like twice, three times the size of a normal wolf. And they were unbelievably tame.
Yeah, including, as you said, George, bulletproof. Almost robotic.
Yeah, they had some very unusual properties. Now, within a few weeks of that last incident with the Chevette at the ranch gate, those animals disappeared from the property and were never seen again. It was like they vanished off the face of the earth. They saw the family saw them in the distance a few times, and then they were gone, never seen again.
Did other creatures replace them? Different kinds of creatures?
Well, throughout the you know, as the whole thing unfolded between 1994 and when NIDS arrived in August of 1996, September 96, there were a variety of unusual creatures seen. The Gormans saw very unusual birds on the property. There were some sightings of what might have been Sasquatch-like creatures in the distance. And then when the NIDS team arrived on the property in 1996.
Now, that's when the Gormans sold, right?
That's when they sold the property after a litany of very, very high strangeness.
Well, did they sell to get out, or did Bigelow and group make such a good offer they had to sell?
Well, they had reached the end of their tether. They had basically been subjected to a series of mind games happening almost on a daily basis for, you know, 18 to 20 months. I had talked about their high-end cattle. Over a period of that 20 months, they lost through either mutilation, death, or disappearance about 12 of their high-end animals out of a herd of 80.
That's
which was
big
an
percent.
Unacceptable attrition rate.
Absolutely.
Financially, it was devastating. It was really a particular incident that happened in May, I believe, of 1996, in which Tom Gorman was watching his dogs on the property. He was sitting outside. He was relaxing. It was an evening when he noticed a blue orb, one of these circular orb objects that had become very, very common occurrences on the property. It was moving quickly close to the ground. The dogs saw it, and Gorman usually protected his animals when any of these objects were in the vicinity. But at this time, he lost his patience, and he set the dogs on this object. They began chasing this object, which was only a few feet off the ground, obviously being guided intelligently.
Basketball size?
It was just smaller than basketball size.
Right.
It was very, very blue. It actually cast a blue light on the ground as it maneuvered. But each time the dogs would lunge at it, it would just skip out of the way, obviously sort of taking evasive maneuvers. And slowly it was leading the dogs towards this dense copse of bushes. As things unfolded, the dogs chased this thing into this dense thicket. And Gorman heard these agonized shrieks of the three animals. Uh-huh. And then sudden silence. He was so scared when he heard that the yelping that he did not go down to investigate. He waited until the following morning. When he went down there, he found three large circles of dried out grass on the ground. And in the middle of each of those circles was this sort of gooey black mess that he surmised was the vaporized remains of his dogs. And it was that sort of terrorized the family, because not only were those three animals good cattle dogs, but they were also family pets. And so it was during that period in 1996 when the Gorman family decided that they finally had enough and that they wanted out. And it was at that stage that they began contacting people, and word got into the media, and through the media, Robert Bigelow and NIDS saw those stories and contacted the Gormans.
But to back up to the scariest stuff, and we'll be talking about some really dramatic incidents like that one. The scariest stuff to me in reading the reports were the tiny incidents that happened, poltergeist-type activity that started right from the beginning after the wolf incident, things disappearing, moving around on their own. The mom of the family goes shopping for groceries, comes home with a couple of weeks' worth of food, takes it out of the bags and puts it in the cabinets, goes to the bathroom, comes back, all the food is back out in the bags again.
Oh, no.
Or she would each morning take a shower. She'd lock the door in the bathroom, put her hairbrush on top of the towel right next to the shower, get out of the shower. The door is still locked, but the brush and the towel are gone. Then find them later, like in the microwave or the freezer. The rancher, Tom Gorman, being out on the range, he was using a post hole digger on one day, stops from his work for just a second, either to brush his brow or to take a drink of water, turns back around, the post hole digger is gone. They find it days later, 30 feet up in a tree. Things of that sort. Which we would categorize as poltergeist type activity. They started hearing disembodied voices above their heads speaking in a strange language, almost in mocking sort of tones. They would see shadowy type beings in the house. All the kinds of things that we would categorize as poltergeist stuff, but which, you know, frankly scares the hell out of me in thinking about it.
Well, you talked about flying objects. Can you rule out that there's any extraterrestrial intervention here?
Well, it's almost impossible to rule that out because the Gorman family sort of were deluged by different sizes and different kinds of objects, ranging from these huge triangular objects to like triangular flying objects to small intelligently guided orbs. To there were small craft that looked like a mini version of the B-2 bomber or F-117 stealth fighter, very small versions of those. There were Mexican hat-shaped objects that were seen by the Gormans and by actually neighbors.
Well, but I don't understand, Colm, why, and we're coming up to the top of the hour, so we may save your answer, but in most cases, extraterrestrial visitations seem to be pretty benevolent. You know, yes, we have reports of abductions, but we don't have this horror that surrounds it. If anything, cattle mutilations may be done for some scientific or genetic reason. Who knows that yet? But in this particular case, there really seems to be some evil surrounded by it. That's at least my impression.
Well, that is one of the things that when we interviewed Junior Hicks, that he really pointed his finger at the property right in the middle of the Uinta Basin. He said in all of the years and decades of his investigations, the property that we're talking about was fairly unique, but because a lot of the events seemed like darker, they seemed more sinister than he was used to investigating.
Let's weigh both of that when we come back, that sinister darkness and then these extraterrestrial craft that they were seeing, because this is very, very, very interesting. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.